Well, my understanding is this is the last talk of the conference. I don't know about you, but I'm exhausted. I've only been here a week. I also have the disadvantage that since before every talk I give, Dan takes me out drinking. So I'm never in very good shape the next morning. But what I want to tell you about today is... that's Dan Freed. F-R-E-E-D. So I want to tell you about a construction of bundles on elliptic manifolds called the parabolic construction. I just barely got started with this last time. I gave you the example of this construction in the case of SLN or vector bundles and a single curve. I'll review that briefly at the beginning today. Then I'll generalize to GC bundles. And then I'll talk about how to do families. That's the outline of what I'm going to do today. So what I did in the case of SLN in a single elliptic curve, I constructed for each integer k a bundle. So this is a vector bundle over E. It's characterized by the fact that it's stable. So it's actually a stable bundle. It's going to have degree 1. And in fact, its determinant is the line bundle of degree 1 concentrated at the origin of the elliptic curve. So this elliptic curve really is an elliptic curve. It has an origin, so it has a group law. And the last stable degree 1, that's its determinant. And I guess the last thing I need to say is it's right. And in fact, if you think about how it's made, it's a series of successive series of extensions, and the associated quotients in order look like this. So if you want to start, I usually start on the right. You start with this line bundle, that's the case k equals 1. You then take an extension of this by O, that's the case, a unique non-trivial extension, that's W2. There's a unique non-trivial extension of that by O, that's W3, and so on. And then we saw that we could make semi-stable vector bundles over the elliptic curve by taking non-trivial extensions. So if V is a non-trivial extension, then V is semi-stable. And I gave you the argument last time. It's intuitively the idea is these bundles are barely unstable. And so when you put them together, the only way V could be unstable, I mean, the sum of these two is barely unstable, and the only thing that destabilizes it is W. So when you make an extension like this, it's W and minus K. If you make an extension like this, the only thing that can destabilize V is again the Wn minus K, which would split the sequence, and therefore, as long as this is a non-trivial sequence, you have a stable bundle. So this gave us then a projective space of the first cohomology that classifies these extensions. So this then, now this space parameterizes a family. Semi-stable maybe I should just stop and to tell you just for a moment how you compute the dimension of this vector space. So we have a tensor product of two stable bundles, so it will be semi-stable. And working over an elliptic curve, it's easy to compute cohomology for semi-stable bundles as long as the degree isn't zero. And the degree here is, in fact, if you do the computation, minus n. So it's non-zero, it's in fact negative. Well, stability tells you, semi-stability tells you, since the degree is negative, there can be no sections. Because this would destabilize. This would be something of slope zero mapping into something of negative slope that would destabilize. That is to say, H naught of this bundle is zero. Well, that's the missing ingredient. On a curve, you have two cohomology groups, and what you can get out of Chern classes is the difference of the ranks of the cohomology. That's what the index term gives you. It's usually called Riemann-Roch in this case. But what you don't know in general is you only know the difference. But for negative degree semi-stable bundles, in fact, there is no H naught, and therefore H1 is equal to the degree. If you have a semi-stable bundle of positive degree, you can use ser-duality to see it will have no H1, and therefore its H0 is rank equal to the degree. If you have a semi-stable bundle of degree 0, then it's a little more delicate. Then you don't know. In fact, it might be a line bundle of degree 0, in which case if it's non-trivial, it has no H0 and no H1. And if it's trivial, it has one degree, one dimension H0 and one dimension H1. So you don't know when the degree is 0. But as long as the degree is non-zero and you know the bundle is semi-stable, you can calculate the cohomology. This is a semi-stable bundle of negative degree n, so this cohomology group is degree, is right, dimension n. And so this projective space is a P. Well, that was exactly the dimension of when we calculated flat connections over the elliptic curve for SUN. We got a projective space, complex projective space of dimension n minus 1. We now have a map from this space to the moduli space, which itself is secretly a n minus 1. And this map is an isomorphism. And, so that's the statement that I made at the end of the hour last time, that every S equivalence class of SLN bundles, semi-stable SLN bundles, has a unique representative in this family. And we also discovered a special property that these bundles have. These bundles are all regular. Dimension of their automorphism group is the dimension of the vector bundle. I think of this as the analog of what's called the Steinberg section. In a complex group, a complex simple group, semi-simple group, you again have this notion of conjugacy classes. Of course, it's slightly different than it was in the compact groups. The actual quotient space is in Hausdorff, but when you make it Hausdorff, you get what you think of as a space of conjugacy classes of elements in the complex group, and there's a section of that back in the group. There's a family of elements. It's called the Steinberg section, and they're all regular elements. So it picks up the regular element in every S equivalence class of matrices, and this somehow is the analog of it. In fact, I think some people have tried to study this, bundles over elliptic curves in terms of elements in the holomorphic loop group, maps of C star into the complex group, and then the analogy would be perfect. These bundles would be regular elements in that loop group. Okay. Well, I want to reformulate this this notion, which is this construction is very much a vector bundle construction. I want to reformulate it in more group theoretic language so I can see how to translate it for other groups besides SLN or orthogonal groups, things like that, the general lever. The way I want to do it is I want to consider what's called a parabolic subgroup inside SLN. So I consider matrices A, secret reasons, all right, A, U here, B transpose inverse. Okay. That's a strange way to write it, but that's it's a set of all matrices blocked here. This is K and N minus K. So this is a subgroup of SLN. It's a subgroup of SLN provided that the determinant of A is equal to the determinant of B. Usually you don't put the transpose inverse here and you say, you look at pairs of matrices A and B such that the product of the determinants is 1. So I flipped it over so I get to write equality of determinants. Well, an extension like this is a bundle over this group. So extension as above, in fact, has structure group reduced from SLNC to this group. This is actually, it's got to be indexed by K. And furthermore, it's not any old bundle over this group. We know explicitly what the bundles, the pieces of the bundle are over this part of the group and this part of the group. So this group P, of course, maps onto the diagonal entries, the A and B inside GL cross GL, such that the determinant of A equals the determinant of B. Okay? And the kernel is this abelian thing up here, the AUs, but I'm just going to. So we have a bundle with structure group over P. We have a principal P bundle. We could reduce it mod this unipotent subgroup. So we have a principal P bundle. We could form, just divide out by the extension part of the information that's up here. And this is, in fact, then a vector bundle, a pair of vector bundles with the same determinant. And what we know is that this is product. I don't know how to write it. Here's a bundle over this group. It's a pair of vector bundles, dimension k and n minus k, with the same determinant. So in fact, another way to say what all these extensions are, they're simply principal bundles over this parabolic subgroup with the property that modulo the unipotent piece of the parabolic subgroup, you get a specific bundle over this semi-simple group. So these V's are principal PK bundles, which mod U, in this sense, are identified with, now if I say it in vector bundle language, say it this way. If this is the, this denotes the principal bundle over this group, because I've taken transpose inverse here, the associated vector bundle that I'm talking about is really this one. In other words, I'm looking at sequences that when you forget the unipotent part, which is the extension data, you simply get this bundle and that bundle. Well, so let me formulate this extension class just slightly differently. Let's think of taking an open covering of the elliptic curve. Then this bundle has some transition functions which are blocked here. So we have the transition functions for this original bundle over this quotient group, and they'll be maybe A, I, J, 0, 0, capital A, B, I, J. So let me, I'm not so good with up and down indices. These indices are the co-cycle indices, not matrix indices. So I'm writing the matrix as a capital letter, and then it has two indices because it's a one co-cycle and is open cover. Okay. So this is the co-cycle description of this bundle. And I could write it out explicitly, but it doesn't really matter. Now, looking for bundles that have structure group P, but which modulo the unipotent part of the group give the original bundle, is looking for ways to extend these co-cycles by putting in an upper left-hand entry. So I want to consider co-cycles A, I, J, U, I, J. You would look for co-chains like this. They're automatically modulo the unipotent, what I started with, but they need to be co-cycles. And the co-cycle condition, well, it's going to be automatic here and here because I started on the diagonal entries with a co-cycle, but I'll get some equation up here, which isn't the usual co-cycle condition here. It's been twisted by the A and the B. And if you think about what it really is, the co-cycle condition for the UIJ is that UIJ is a one co-cycle with respect to this cover, not with trivial coefficients, but with coefficients exactly in the tensor product of these two bundles. Pass from one open set to another, the co-cycle condition gets twisted by the A's and B's in exactly this way, as you can just work out by multiplying out the matrices. Well, I'm interested then, of course, in the cohomology class of this, and that's the extension class. So I've just reformulated in this matrix language what we already knew. Yeah. I do, yes. So, I mean, if I did it without the transpose inverse, it would look like HOM of one into the other. But because I dropped the transpose inverse on you, but because I decided to make this one transpose inverse, that takes the dual of the bundle. So. Yeah, so secretly there's a transpose inverse here. No, because the extension data is the dual of this one tensor that one. And I built the duality into my matrices by taking transpose inverse here. I didn't have to do that. But no, this is the right thing. So we get the same cohomology group. I just tried to explain it in the more abstract group theoretic language, but it's exactly what you're doing up here when you classify these extensions. You just don't need to say it this way. Okay, well, now we're in a position, having formulated it this way, to try to generalize to an arbitrary group. So I need to tell you about parabolic subgroups. First, let me define a parabolic subgroup for you. A parabolic subgroup is a connected subgroup whose Lie algebra P inside the Lie algebra of G contains to conjugation. So we only think about these groups up to conjugation in G. So up to conjugation contains the Lie algebra of the maximal torus together with the root spaces for all positive roots. So I'm implicitly here, I fixed a maximal torus for the group and I fixed a set of simple roots. That then gives me a notion of positive roots, and I want the Lie algebra has to contain the Lie algebra of the torus and all the positive root spaces. If I made different choices, I'd get something conjugate, and I only care about these groups up to conjugation anyway. So this is an invariant notion. By the way, the groups that exactly have this as their Lie algebra are called Borel subgroups. Yeah, if I put root spaces, I'm secretly, at least, or this is a complex Lie algebra. I mean, this notion makes sense in the compact group, but you're right when I write root spaces. So these are the so-called Borel subgroups. They're the minimal parabolics. They are parabolics, clearly, because they contain themselves. And they're the smallest parabolics. And a parabolic is any connected group that contains a Borel. Now, it turns out these are not too hard to classify up to conjugation. And the classification is in terms of the Dynkin diagram. So you begin with the Dynkin diagram, the ordinary Dynkin diagram of the group, and you take some subdiagram. This is an arbitrary subdiagram. It has to be proper, but it can be empty. Proper means it's not the whole Dynkin diagram. Okay. Then you take, for the Lie algebra of the parabolic that's going to go with this D, you take the maximal torus. So I'll complexify again. You take all the root spaces A such that the coefficient of A on each deleted node is positive, is greater than equal to zero. Okay. For example, if I took the empty diagram as my subdiagram, I would have deleted all the nodes, and I now require every coefficient to be greater than or equal to zero. Well, zero, of course, is not allowed, so I'm talking about the set of positive roots. So the empty diagram goes with the Borel. Okay. Well, the obvious inclusion of diagrams here is subdiagrams of the given diagram is reflected in the inclusion of parabolics. So up to conjugation, one parabolic will be included in another if and only if the subdiagram for the first is a subset, or the nodes is a subset of the second. So the maximal parabolics, which will be the ones we're interested in, are obtained by deleting single node. If you didn't delete any nodes and you wrote this definition down, you would recover the entire Lie algebra of G, and therefore the entire group. And G is not considered a parabolic group, subgroup of itself. So if you want to know how many maximal parabolics there are up to conjugation in the group, the answer is it's the rank of the group and one for each node in the Dynkin diagram. And the parabolic, then, the Lie algebra of the parabolic looks like the tangent space of the Lie algebra plus all root spaces, so the coefficient
of A on the distinguished vertex, the one that you're deleting, is greater than or equal to zero. So let's do the example of SLN. Well, the diagram for SLN is chain of length n minus 1. These are not the integers I put on the nodes before. I'm just indexing them now. So I can leave out any integer. I can leave out the node labeled k, and that produces, when you work all this out, exactly the parabolic . So you have all the roots ei minus ej if I and j are in this part of the diagram or they're over here. But you can't span across this node. That's what you're missing, and that's these roots. So I have, in fact, my construction worked in the case of SLN for any integer k between 1 and n minus 1. So I could have done the construction of extensions for any one of these nodes. That is, I could have done it over any of the maximal parabolics of n. Now, in this case, we had a nice exact sequence for the group, which is reflected in general. We had the entire parabolic group. We had what was called its unipotent subgroup, the strictly upper triangular matrices, and then that was a normal subgroup, and we could divide out by it and get a semi-simple, but rather a reductive group. That continues to hold here. If you have a parabolic subgroup, it has a normal, if you have a parabolic subgroup of G, it has a normal subgroup, which is unipotent, consists in some sense of upper triangular matrices, and the quotient, which is a reductive group, is called the Levy factor. And in fact, for general reasons, you can always split this sequence and write, if you want, T is L times U, though L is not a normal subgroup. So in the case of, let me just describe this in the case of a maximal parabolic, the only place I'm going to use it. The unipotent is made out of the positive roots whose negatives are not root spaces in the group. Well, so you see the unipotent, or Lie algebra here, is simply the direct sum of the root spaces, GA, where the coefficient of A on the distinguished vertex V is strictly positive. So, for example, in this case, when you have a root EI minus EJ that spans across this missing vertex, you write it as a sum of simple roots. The coefficients are 1, 1, 1, 1. The coefficient here is positive. So this is the unipotent subgroup, at least it's Lie algebra, and then the Levy factor is simply the quotient by that. And so the maximal torus of the Levy factor is the original torus T in the group. And the Dynkin diagram for L is what I called DP before. It is the part of the Dynkin diagram that you kept. Because after all, the roots in L, what are the roots in L? Those are all the root spaces where the coefficient of A on the vertex is zero. Well, that's linear combinations of all the other roots, which happen to be roots. Well, those are exactly the roots that you see on this Dynkin diagram. So this Dynkin diagram tells you the semi-simple part of L. It's not a semi-simple group because this diagram is definitely a smaller rank group, and the maximal torus of L is still the maximal torus of the full group. And in fact, if you ask, that is to say the roots, the co-roots don't span the entire vector space. They span a subspace. The roots span a subspace. And in this case of maximal parabolics, it's codimension 1. I'm going to put over here one more very important fact. The center of the levee is C star, or at least the component of the identity of the center of the C star. So this is a measure of the difference between the rank of L, the dimension of its maximal torus, and how much the roots span in the maximal torus. They span a subspace, and this is perpendicular to that subspace, at least in Lie algebra. No, if by rank you mean the dimension of the maximal torus, it's got the same maximal torus. Right. So you have this extra, but if you think about it, it's what's called derived group. That's the semi-simple group. The semi-simple subgroup of L is, in fact, its derived group. That's always true. It's all commutators. That's a semi-simple group, and its rank is, in this case, well, it's this group, so its rank is one less. So that's right. So in SLN, it is S of GLK cross GLN minus K. So the semi-simple part of the group is SLK cross SLN minus K, and you have an extra C star to make up the rest of the torus. This is the levee in that case, yeah. Yeah, thanks, man. All right. So for these maximal parabolics, you always get a single C star. It's perpendicular to all the root spaces that remain in the levee. If I dropped out two vertices, I would get C star cross C star. If I dropped out three vertices, I'd get three C stars and so on. If I drop them all out, I get a group which has only the maximal torus and the unipotent stuff. It has no root spaces left in it, no semi-simple part left anymore. So it's a product of C stars. That's the Borel. Now, okay. Now I'm going to pick out a parabolic for you. So each group, each simple group, I guess I'm working the complex group now, except those of AN type, has a best for what I'm about to do, parabolic. So there is in every Dinkin diagram except the AN Dinkin diagrams where we can use any vertex, a best parabolic, a best vertex in the Dinkin diagram. I imagine if I asked you to guess what it was, at least in the simply laced case, you could guess. It's the trivalent vertex. So the best parabolic is going to be maximal parabolic. It's going to go with a node. So the node is the trivalent node. For simply laced groups, and for non-simply laced groups, it's the long trivalent. Well, trivalent's maybe not quite. It's the long root on the multiple bond. So, for example, for F4. Which sort of looks trivalent to me. Well, certainly looks trivalent there. This one. And of course, the short one's also trivalent in both of these cases. Now, the one case where it really doesn't look so trivalent is in C, this one. All right. All the things that I told you in the last couple of days about groups and commuting elements and so on, basically I was able, or we were able to establish in a classification-free way. We had conceptual, qualitative arguments about what was going on. In fact, I sometimes think we could have shortened our arguments by a factor of about 50% if we just said, here's the statement, check it in all the cases. But we decided not to do that. At this point, I am reduced to the cases. I don't have really a qualitative description of why this is the right parabolic. There is in a bot in a Tia Bot in their paper on long paper on Yang Mills over Riemann surfaces, there is an ordering of the parabolic groups. And these parabolics are smallest in that order. So it's probably something there. I don't know how to say these groups except to list all cases. Let's say these vertices except to list all cases. But the point is that these vertices, these parabolics, give the smallest, the least unstable bundles. So there will be over these parabolics unstable bundles, the analogs of my WK cross W, WK star cross WN minus K, which are minimally unstable among all bundles as you move over all parabolics. So this is somehow the smallest parabolic in from the sense of instability, and over it there is the smallest unstable bundle. And one way in which it's smallest is that all its non-trivial deformations become semi-stable. If you take other parabolics, in fact what happens in the Atiyah Bot pictures, you take other parabolics, you deform, you take an unstable bundle over that parabolic, as you deform it, well, you'll get semi-stable bundles sometimes, but you can also get unstable bundles that exist over lower parabolics. So I've gone down to the bottom. But how to say where the bottom is, conceptually, I don't know. So here's a fact that you can easily check. The semi-simple part of the levy for these maximal parabolics is always described as a product, as a subgroup of a product of GL in I of matrices A1 up to AP of common determinants. And the C star quotient is the common determinant. I said this is the semi-simple part. This is the levy. And the common determinant is the homomorphism from the levy to C star. So that explains why I went through all these shenanigans with SLN. The general picture is a collection of matrices with common determinant. So it's actually a question of, when you think of SLN, you tend to think of it going this way. So the first piece of it is an SLK, and the second piece is an SLN minus K, but headed the wrong way. You want it to head back toward the special vertex. Well, flipping over SLK is transpose inverse. So these GLs are all, I mean, think of the trivalent vertex. You always identify them with SL so that they point toward the vertex. Anyway, this is what the levy looks like. It's pretty clear, for example, in E8, if I drop out the trivalent vertex, I get here an A2, an A1, and an A5. So at least the semi-simple part is SL2 cross SL3 cross SL5, and you have to think a little bit to make sure that the full group is described as a matrix in GL5, GL3, and GL2 with common determinant, but it is. Huh? No. A4, no, it's A5. Okay. Well, once I know that the levy looks like that, I have a fairly obvious candidate, I have a fairly obvious bundle to take. So I want a principal bundle over this group, which sits as a product, it sits inside a product of GLN, so it's going to be then some collection of vector bundles of these degrees, these ranks, with common determinant. Well, the bundle I have is WN1 star. So this is a principal bundle. Over 11. The collection of bundles of the given ranks. These integers in I, of course, depend on the diagram. They're what you read off the diagram. So I have a collection of bundles. There'll either be two or three of them, with T. But for trivalent vertices, you'll get three factors, and in the non-simply laced case, you'll either get one or two factors. So this is a principal bundle over L, which looks minimally unstable. Again, well, produces a G bundle, which looks minimally unstable. Let's call that bundle eta. So it's a principal L bundle, maybe I'll call it eta L, over my elliptic curve. And now I want to consider exactly what I did before. I want to consider isomorphism classes. It out over to a bundle over the whole parabolic, so that when I reduce mod the unipotent part, I get back the bundle I started with. So this is the analog of taking a non-trivial extension of the pieces. This is the group theoretic analog. Yeah. Well, the extension is the P bundle. I mean, one P bundle I could take is where I don't do anything in the unipotent. And I will get then an unstable bundle. That would be the analog of the trivial extension giving me the direct sum. But I'm going to be interested in non-trivial extensions, non-trivial liftings. And we'll talk about what the space of all those is really like and so on in just a minute. Rank 2 case. So you're talking about G2? No. G. Yes. In fact, the group is GL2. So I have one. I have W2 or W2 star. Well, I don't think of this really as a tensor product either. I think of this as, I mean, maybe I should put commas here. I'm thinking of a principal bundle over a product of groups. Well, that's just a principal bundle over each group in the product. And I've chosen, instead of to write the frame bundle, I've chosen, since it's GLN, I've chosen to write those as vector bundles. So, I mean, you might want to put exterior tensor, or you might want to put commas. Or in the case of G2, I only have T as 1, and I have one vector bundle, which would be W2 star. Well, what are these classified by? Well, it works just like it did before in terms of cocycles. I have an L cocycle that gives the original bundle, so Lij. This is the L cocycle giving the L bundle. So I have some open cover of the elliptic curve that I've suppressed, and these are the transition functions. So Lij is a holomorphic function from Ui intersect Uj, that open analytic open subset of the elliptic curve, into L, which is, I'm thinking of as a complex group. And they satisfy the cocycle condition. They build this bundle. Now I'm interested in building P bundles. Well, any group element in P looks like this. Maybe I should write it as L times U ij. With the given L's, and Uij is a map. Excuse I don't have too many R's, I have too many U's. This is the unipotent subgroup, and these are the open subsets. Well, I guess I really strictly have to put the IJ in both places. So I'm going to vary the cocycle, or vary the cochain, by simply taking what I had in L and multiplying it by something, the analog of my upper triangular matrix, multiplying it by an analytic function into the unipotent part. The cocycle condition, again, is twisted, and I'll just write it out here, Lij, Uij times Ljk, Ujk is supposed to equal Lik, Uik. That's the cocycle condition in the full group. Well, pull the L past the U, and you have Lij, Ljk, Uij to the Ljk, Ujk is supposed to be Lik, Uik. This part is automatic. That's the cocycle condition in L that I started with. So I can get rid of this piece. And the cocycle condition for these U's isn't the ordinary cocycle condition, it's this twisted version of it. So it's a twisted cocycle condition. There's a similar computation to tell you what the twisted co-boundaries are. Something like co-boundary would be setting Uij equal to Ui, maybe Uj to the Lij in the inverse somewhere. Something like that. Anyway, you can form a family of twisted cocycles, modulo the twisted co-boundaries, and they exactly classify these objects right here. So we have some kind of H1, I'll write it this way, the elliptic curve with coefficients in this unipotent group twisted by this vector bundle, or twisted by this principal element. Now we are outside the classical cohomology now, because this is not a representation of the group. This is a non-abelian group we're talking about. This is some kind of non-abelian cohomology. It's itself not a group. You can't multiply or add cocycles. So there isn't a group structure on this group, on this set of cocycles into the group. So this is a slightly non-standard object. In the case of SLN, it was perfectly standard because in the case of SLN, the unipotent subgroup was abelian. So you were just talking about a vector group, and this was the cohomology of a representation, a vector representation in a principal bundle. That's just the cohomology of the associated vector bundle. Here I have the cohomology of this associated bundle of unipotent groups. L acts on U, which is the unipotent group, and I have a bundle over L, so this is a bundle of unipotent groups associated with this principal bundle, and I'm trying to take some kind of cocycles. So it's not a vector space. It does have an origin. That's one thing. We have the trivial cocycle set to U is equal to 1. So we have an origin. And because the center of L acts as automorphisms of this principal bundle and also on the unipotent group, I have a C star action. From the action of the center of L. So I have something, I'll say a little bit more about it in a minute, that I don't know too much about. It does have an origin, and it does have a C star action. Now, if we were in the case of SLN, where U were an abelian group, I could identify U with this Lie algebra, and I would get ordinary vector bundle cohomology. That's not the case here, but I'm only off by a filtration. You see, U is naturally filtered. We have an increasing filtration, which I'll choose to write this way. And let me tell you what it is on the Lie algebra level first. On the Lie algebra level, we have a grading, because the C star, which is the center of U, acts on the Lie algebra of U, And it just ticks off the coefficient of the missing vertex. So, in fact, at the level of U algebra, at the level of the algebras, I just have a direct sum. Now, these are not sub-algebras, but they're sub-spaces. And the C star acts on UI with weight I. Because the C star, I mean, these, think of these spaces as going with roots. The roots have coefficient on the node that you remove to get the parabolic, the trivalent vertex. And this is the splitting by that coefficient and the weight. The C star actually exactly picks that off. And it's pretty easy. It's obvious, right? If you bracket UI and UJ, you end up in UI plus J. Because when you bracket, you're simply adding roots. When you bracket root spaces, you get into the... And this is the coefficient of that vertex, so it adds. So that means that you can... UN plus UN minus 1... UN minus 1 plus UN minus 2 and so on are all subalgebras, normal subalgebras. And you can exponentiate them down to get this sequence. In fact, this is a sequence of central extensions. If you look at UK divided by UK plus 1 and consider it in, sure, this is right, yeah, inside U divided by UK plus 1, it's in the center. So it's abelian, clearly. And furthermore, it's central in the full group if you divide it out by U, K plus 1. So the bottom one, UN, is an abelian group, and it's in the center of the entire Unicode group. So if my filtration were of length 1, that would be the case of SLN and SP. This would be a vector group. I could identify the unipotent group, which is abelian, with the Lie algebra, and I'd be done. In general, I just have a filtration by things that can be identified with vector spaces. Well, this produces, by standard spectral sequence argument, a filtration on cohomology. We have, for example, the bottom piece. This is just an ordinary vector bundle of eta, and this is ordinary vector bundle cohomology. So this is something we understand. It's a nice vector space. Finite dimensional vector space of cohomology of a vector bundle. And then it sits inside H1 of E U N minus 1 of eta. That's something we don't understand because this is not abelian now. But the quotient is H1 of E U N minus 1 mod U N of eta L. This is another vector group. And in general, it's a spectral sequence, but because the curve is only dimension 1 and the degrees of these bundles are all negative, there's no H0, so in fact, I have an exact sequence. To think about what exact sequence really means, but here you have a vector group, here you have a vector group, and in fact, this vector group acts on this non-abelian cohomology, and this is the orbit space. So... if n is 2 or more, you're fine, right? Because the brackets here, if, right. So what I have is I have this cohomology space. It's got a filtration on it, and in fact, it has this vector, finite dimensional vector space acting on it with a vector space's quotient. And that's a general fact out of algebraic geometry. If you have an algebraic... affine algebraic variety, and it has a vector group acting on it, and the quotients are a vector space that in fact is affine space. So this is an affine space. It is isomorphic as an algebraic variety to AN, affine space of dimension N, and we keep going. Now, at the next stage, we have a vector group acting on a bigger space with an affine spaces quotient. But again, algebraic geometry tells you that's an affine space. So in the end, what we have is that this cohomology space H1E U of A to L is an affine space. Sort of funny, usually you use the word affine to mean something that's identified with a vector space, except you don't know where the origin is, so up the translations. This means simply something algebraically isomorphic to AN, to that affine, to that algebraic variety. Because this one has an origin. That's one thing it does have. And it has a C-star action. So we have an affine space with a marked point and a C-star action. This point, of course, is fixed under the C-star action. And it's filtered so that the associated quotients are vector spaces on which C-star acts linearly but with weights, the weight given by this index. So it's filtered with associated gradients being vector spaces, finite dimensional vector spaces, with linear C star actions of weight given by the index. So a particular positive weight. So if I did the example of dn, in dn, this number is 2. There's only 1s and 2s in the Dinkin diagram. So I have a two-step extension. This is a four-dimensional vector space, and this is an n-minus four-dimensional vector space. So the C-star action has two weights, 1 and 2. It has a four-dimensional quotient on which it acts by weight 1, and it has an n-minus four-dimensional subspace on which it acts by weight 2. That's the picture. That's the picture of this cohomology. Well, exactly what was true in the SLN case for any any maximal parabolic is true here for this parabolic. So the theorem is, if we take this non-abelian cohomology, take out the origin and divide by the C star action. This is isomorphic to the moduli space. Semi-stable. Maybe I should have preliminary to that said, first part of the theorem is that any non-trivial extension, as long as you're not at the origin, the bad point, the split point, you get a semi-stable bundle. So this is a reflection of what I said earlier about any deformation of this bundle is indeed semi-stable. So all the non-zero bundles, all the non-zero extension classes give semi-stable bundles. The C-star orbits give isomorphic bundles. That's sort of obvious. Because it's an automorphism of the whole picture. And therefore, this quotient space parameterizes a family of semi-stable bundles. In fact, it parameterizes every S equivalence class exactly once. So that's the first thing. The second thing is all these bundles are regular in the sense that they're automorphisms as GC bundles. The rank of the automorphism group is the rank of G. And that's the minimum dimension over all bundles. So this is the complete analog of what happened in the SLN case. The non-trivial extensions are always semi-stable, and you divide out by the C-star action on the non-trivial extensions, you get the regular representative in every semi-stable class. Well, now you see we have Malinga's theorem because it's also a fact in algebraic geometry, if you have an affine space and a C star action with the origin is fixed and positive weights, so that's something that you calculate at the, you look at the fixed point for the C star action and you look at the differential of the C star action, that's a linear action, and I want that action to have positive weights, then the action is linearizable. There's an isomorphism between this affine space and the tangent space, this affine space at the origin, so that the C star action becomes the linear one over here. So in fact, this doesn't have a natural vector space structure on it, but abstractly up to isomorphism, you can put a vector space structure on it so that this is a linear action. And the weights are the weights I read off in the filtration. So it's a weighted projective space I'm talking about now, not non-projective space. The construction of this map. Oh, yes, that's right. It's completely general nonsense in algebraic geometry. There is no canonical isomorphism. No, no canonical coordinates here. It's just something about C stars in the automorphism group. That's right. Not from this description. So the quotient then is a weighted projective space. Something else that I don't understand, so this is exactly what Luenga got, a weighted projective space. He described the weights in terms of the co-root integers. We've described them here in terms of dimensions of certain cohomology of a unipotent subgroup associated to a particular parabolic. Now, it is true, not surprisingly, that these notions agree, as I have checked case by case. I have no understanding of why these numbers work, but they do. So why the co-root integers, which are what come out from either the study directly of the elements, commuting elements, as I was doing on Wednesday, you actually see the co-root integers coming out because you see the alcove coming out. Or Luenga's picture in terms of theta functions, proving this is a weighted projective space, which also uses the co-root integers. The co-root integers here seem far, far away. I have one particular vertex, and I'm looking at dimensions of the number of roots that have coefficient 1 on that vertex, coefficient 2, coefficient 3, dividing by a certain number which is embedded in the C star action. And those are the dimensions that are going to come out. And I see no relationship with the co-root integers except that they're equal. All right. So that's how you build bundles on a single elliptic curve. We actually build a family of bundles. They're all semi-stable and regular, and they represent up to S equivalence, every S equivalence class, uniquely. So let me finish with a few minutes about families. So what happens in families? First, I better tell you what a family, yeah. What's in fact is just another copy of the, yeah. You've just taken the unipotent subgroup and taken the opposite version of it and put in the C star. Right. That's right. there is a natural action, I believe that action is trivial. There's certainly I thought about these sorts of things in a related way where the action is trivial. Could be. Anyway, I guess the full unipotent subgroup is an orbit of that nilpotent group, right? Just take the top root and pull down. All right, families. First, let me tell you what I mean by a family of elliptic curves. I haven't said really much about what my elliptic curve is. All I've said is it's a genus 1, smooth, and has an origin. And the natural way to think about those curves is in terms of the Weierstrass equation. So any elliptic curve can be presented, any curve of genus 1 can be presented this way. This is the affine equation. You projectivize it in P2. And the special point that I'm taking is the point where x equals 0, y equals 1, and homogeneously z equals 0. So that's the point at infinity in the affine model. That's the point you don't see before you put in the homogeneous coordinate. And that's all. So these curves are not always smooth. If they are smooth, they have genus 1. They become non-smooth at what's called the discriminant locus, which is something like 4g2q plus 27g3 squared. And if both g2 and g3 are 0, in fact, the curve has a cusp. So if you vary over all G2 and G3, you get smooth elliptic curves. You get nodal curves, rational nodal curves. And you get cusps, cubic cusps. But this point at infinity is always a smooth point, even if the curve itself happens to be single. Okay, now we want to do this in families and have the point at infinity moving in families. That means that we're going to take a family of Weierstrass models. So we have some base, which is the parameter space of the family. B, let's call it, the base. And I need over it a line bundle. And then G2 is going to be a section of L to the fourth. G3 is going to be a section of L to the sixth. And if you do that and consider the projective bundle over B associated with the trivial line bundle L squared and L cubed, this is the Z coordinate, this is the X coordinate, this is the Y coordinate. This equation, the same symbols, Z y squared equals x cubed plus g2 x z squared plus g3 z cubed now describes a surface of one higher dimensional subvariety inside this P2, which point by point in the base, that is fiber by fiber, well, at any fiber you simply evaluate the sections g2 and g3, you get points in the line bundle, you identify the line bundle with C, so you get an equation like this where G2 and G3 are now numbers, so you have an elliptic curve or maybe one of these singular models, fiber by fiber. So this is a family of elliptic curves which may degenerate in these very simple ways. I also have the section at infinity, which puts into families this point. I guess I should call it wide. It's this point in projective space. And it's always smooth. So I have over the base a family of elliptic curves, hitting some singularity sometimes, and a section which runs through the smooth points. And in order to build this, I need a line bundle L and two sections, one of L to the fourth and one of L to the sixth. Well, now I want to do the construction I just did on a single elliptic curve for this family Z. Well, the group theory doesn't change. I still have the same set of groups. I still have the same maximal parabolics, the same vertices, same sorts of cohomology to think about. But I need a global version of my bundle, A to L. And that was built out of the WKs. So I need a global version, script WK over Z, which fiber by fiber is the WK we talked about before. Well, I have that because I have the section. That's what the section gives me. So I can look at, for example, the first one will simply be that line bundle. The line bundle associated with the divisor, which is the second. W2 will be an extension of this line bundle by the trivial line bundle. I need to compute the extension cohomology, the cohomology that classifies these extensions. But I know fiber by fiber what it looks like. It's a one-dimensional space, fiber by fiber, and the local to global spectral sequence tells you, in fact, the unique extension here as well. So you keep going. Once again, you calculate cohomology fiber by fiber, and you see there's a unique extension here, and it is non-trivial on every fiber. So you just keep going. You build the WK. So once we have the WK, everything works like before. I calculate this unipotent cohomology, which again I can compute because I know it on every fiber and I do a local to global spectral sequence. In fact, I can linearize that cohomology globally, and this cohomology is non-abelian cohomology. Is not canonically, but it is a direct sum of line bundles. Well, in fact, powers of the original line bundle. So I told you that fiber by fiber, it was, well, I told you it was a vector space, but in fact, as you move over the base, it's a direct, that split is a direct sum of line bundles. And these, the coefficients, the powers of L that come in are interesting. They're the Casimir weights. So, for D, they're, what are they for D? Well, for A, they're 0, 2, 3, 4, so on. For A and for D, they're 0, 2, 4, 6, N, 8, N. This is the weight one piece, and this is the weight two. So you can say explicitly what these cohomology groups look like. So then a section, fiber by fiber, a section of this cohomology group, that is sections of these line bundles, produces for me a bundle because it's got a cocycle. So I'm actually constructing a global bundle on Z, which fiber by fiber is what my extension classes give me. So in fact, this cohomology group and then the sections of it, which are just sections of those direct sums of line bundles, produce vector bundles over Z, which fiber by fiber are these semi-stable regular bundles. The sections of this cohomology. Global bundles on the infold, n plus one fold Z, which fiber by fiber are regular semi-stable. Just the bundles we talked about a few minutes ago on the single fiber. Yeah, I need to have, I mean, my section, if all my sections degenerated at a point in the base, then I wouldn't have, the bundle would be bad over that fibers. I'm imagining that not these sections don't all vanish at the same time. No, because I'm not building it by doing something fiber by fiber. See, I have an isomorphism between the global cohomology and the R0 pylor star. So these sections are global cohomology classes in the sense of, cocycles. So they are at the same time sections of these bundles, and therefore something fiber by fiber, and an actual bundle on Z. There's none of that sort of stuff. There is, however, a related issue, which is a very delicate one. You can ask now, there could be other bundles on Z which fiber by fiber agree with these at the isomorphism. And that, the class of those, I mean, the study of those is classified by H1 of the automorphism sheet fiber by fiber. And this is a rather complicated object. When the base is a curve, you can actually maybe get some handle on this. As the base gets higher dimensional, this is mysterious to me. In the case of SLN, it's okay. This turns out to be what's called O star of the spectral cover. So you're just talking about line bundles on some spectral cover. But for more general groups, it's mysterious, I think it's fair to say. So by no means am I finding all bundles. I'm just given these sections, that is a family of semi-stable bundles, I have a way to put them together into a global bundle through this cohomology construction. But there may be lots of other bundles which fiber by fiber look like that. And classifying those, I think, is very interesting, but it's beyond what I know how to do right now. All right, well, that's plenty of this.